Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, part two in our week-long series, Taking the Long View, looking beyond the war on terror. In this hour, we'll look 10 years out at the future of energy and the possibility of an American economy breaking free from the tyranny of oil. First, broadening the base of operations for the war in Afghanistan, U.S. officials are seeking access to three former Soviet military bases in Tajikistan. Earlier today, I spoke to retired Brigadier General John Ruppert. I asked him why the United States was pushing for the use of these bases.
I believe the reason that they're requesting the bases is to give them more immediate access to the places where the war is being carried on within Afghanistan. As to what is going on in Afghanistan, we are obviously changing phases, involving more ground troops and more direct support for the Northern Alliance.
Tajikistan has a neighbor, has particular stake and vulnerability in regard to what happens in Afghanistan, doesn't it? And quite a political situation of its own.
Tajikistan, since 1991, has been an extremely fragile state. They were one of the 15 created with the collapse of the Soviet Union, but the only one that has never been able to get both feet on the ground in running its internal affairs. It has been sustained through the presence of initially a Soviet and then a Russian division, the 207th, that has provided protection on its southern border, specifically against incursions from both rebels and from forces from Afghanistan. And so they are tremendously interested in the outcome of this, and a stable and solid Afghanistan would allow it to perhaps regain its own stability and independence for the first time.
Is there a fundamentalist Islamic movement within Tajikistan?
There is. Their argument is that it is supported and sustained by forces outside of Tajikistan, but that premise has never been tested since they have been unable to adequately secure their borders against outside influence to see if it would die of a natural death internally if it were not supported from outside. But that is their argument.
Does the fact that Tajikistan has never really found its feet politically make it more open to U.S. forces coming in there? Does it need the money or feel that it needs the U.S. support in addition to the Russian presence?
I wouldn't say more open. It makes it a little more complex. Tajikistan, because of their continuing requirement for Russian military support and presence in order to sustain any form of government in Dushanbe, the capital, requires not only some internal considerations of how it will impact, but also the explicit consent of Moscow for the nature and the types of support that they are providing.
On the other hand, Moscow appears to have been fairly supportive so far.
Moscow has been very supportive, particularly at a political level. However, as recently as 3 weeks ago, the chief of their general staff, a General Kovashnin, was traveling in the area of Tajikistan and said that he would oppose the presence of U.S. forces at the bases in that area. Now, President Putin can override him, but it is not an effortless call on overriding your senior uniformed military officer during a military operation.
Why would a senior Russian general specifically oppose the U.S. at those bases?
Kovashnin is in some ways still associated with the old school. His concern is that, like the Middle East, if the U.S. establishes bases in that area, even on a temporary basis, temporary for us may be a much longer term than they are prepared to tolerate, and we could become the dominant force in that region as opposed to the role that Russia has historically played.
Well, what about that? In the Gulf War, the United States established bases in Saudi Arabia. Those bases are still there, and conceptually, I guess, they're there in perpetuity. Is that what the United States now wants in Tajikistan or something else?
I think it is something much different. In Saudi Arabia, the reason that we are there is because of our continuing interest in the oil supply that is critical to our economy. The reason that we are in Afghanistan is the presence and the harboring of terrorists within that region, that if that problem is dealt with, there are no economic interests, there are no political interests or other factors that would keep us in the area, and maintaining overseas bases of that type is an expensive and difficult proposition.
So if these new bases are established, what's the nature of the missions that could be carried out from bases in Tajikistan that are difficult or impossible now?
Well, if you had bases on the three air bases in the southern part of Tajikistan, formerly operated by the Soviet Union during their military conflict, you would be able, with alert crews, to respond to crises with the need for aerial support within 5 to 10 minutes, as opposed to the forces that are currently operating off carriers that would require some 30 minutes to get to the same target. For forces on the ground, the 20-minute difference could be a matter of life and death.
General, what's your view of how the war is unfolding in Afghanistan, and where do you stand on this bigger ground war thrust that some people are arguing in favor of now?
I think that generally the operation there has unfolded very well. The thing that has been missing is some visible form of victory, the capture or killing of one of the significant leaders of al-Qaeda, or the collapse of the government in some major portion of Afghanistan or in Kabul itself. My personal prediction is that prior to the 17th of November, the beginning of Ramadan, we will see one or more of those victories specifically achieved because of the concern that we show some kind of progress and have a reason for sustaining operations during the more difficult time in the winter ahead.
We've come to think of the U.S. military as extremely wary of being bogged down in any conflict anywhere. Do you feel that wariness inside the Pentagon, inside the U.S. military now about Afghanistan?
There is clearly a concern of putting large numbers of troops on the ground, the 10 to 12,000 man divisions that we have. We are still very reluctant to do that because then they become targets as well as instruments of our power. And so I think that we still carry the burden of the fear of another Vietnam or another something in which we get bogged down for a long period of time.
And yet, can we get to something we can call victory without that greater application of force?
I think we can. I think that the government of the Taliban is still more fragile than many people believe that it is, that they are under considerable pressure already. And I think that we can, through special operations missions and the cooperation in the Northern Alliance, put great pressure on the al-Qaeda leadership and organization and make them far less effective than they have been previously in Afghanistan.
Retired Brigadier General John Ruppert is Executive Research Director at the Belfer Center at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. I spoke to him earlier from his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Imagine powering your car with the same fuel cell that powers your home. Imagine sending the power company a bill instead of getting one. Imagine an America indifferent to the price and the geopolitics of oil. As they say, we have the technology. But do we have the political will? America's dependence on oil binds the country to the volatile politics of the Middle East. Does it have to be that way? Are American leaders in government and industry ready to invest in alternative energy technologies? And are you willing to change your energy-wasting ways? We're taking the long view of energy options and consequences tonight. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us tonight from Berkeley, California, is Daniel Kamen. He's professor of nuclear engineering at the University of California, Berkeley, and founding director of the Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory. Good evening, Professor Kamen.
Good evening, and I probably should correct that. I'm also actually a professor in something called the Energy and Resources Group, as well as the Goldman School of Public Policy.
Great. Great on all counts. Also with us is Carl Robigo. He's the former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Energy in the Clinton administration. Currently, he's managing director at the Rocky Mountain Institute. He joins us from Denver. Hello, Carl Robigo.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. And with us in our studio tonight in Boston is special coverage news analyst Jack Beatty, a senior editor for the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hi, Tom.
There's a lot to dive into here. Daniel Kamen, if we could, let's dive in with you first. We're looking out this week, 10 years ahead, trying to look through the fog of war, trying to start out well in this war on terrorism and everything that follows by beginning well, by having the end in mind. Looking 10 years out on the energy front, how much can we realistically reduce our dependence on fossil fuels and maybe on nuclear energy as well in the next 10 years?
Well, over the next decade, we could actually do a huge amount. And what you said in the intro was right. It's at this point much more a question of political willpower and willingness to change to options that are technically sound and have proven to be economically sound. So we could, for example, over the next decade, see a significant fraction of power generation coming from clean renewables, which already in many cases are as cheap or cheaper than fossil fuel options. Wind is one that's right on that edge right now. We could also see things like you drive your fuel cell car to work, you plug it in at work, sell power back, drive it home, power your home. And you could also see nuclear power plants, other large-scale power plants generating not just electricity but hydrogen to be used in a hydrogen economy. We could see biomass energy making up a significant fraction of energy supply. All of these things are technically possible now. There are some critical areas where we need to do some research, but the real thing is we need to allow these markets to develop. And so far, our fossil fuel-based economy has done everything it can to retard those sorts of innovations, even when we discover that it's actually not just cost-effective, but we make money by saving energy. And we've seen that over the last few decades where, for example, the U.S. economy is now almost 40% more efficient at generating GNP and revenue for the same amount of energy, and yet we aren't seeing that sort of new mindset being embraced, so that people still think that renewables are a bit player, a niche market here and there, as opposed to seeing the ways in which clean energy could really be the mainstay of our economy.
Dan Kamen, I want to be sure we've got the bottom line of what you're saying. And is it that technically, we could be free of oil dependence within a decade? Or is it something
else? Not
free.
No, it's a longer transition than that. I mean, one of the key lessons from economics is that too rapid transitions tend to be the most costly ones. But well-planned transitions can not only be economically inexpensive, but they can make money in unexpected ways. So, for example, when the U.S. went through the process of phasing out CFCs, the Montreal Protocol, and aerosols, we discovered, the companies that were using CFCs discovered that they could do the same jobs cheaper and more environmentally friendly. And so rushing it is a mistake, but what we've been doing is dragging our feet.
So we don't want to rush it. We don't want to drag our feet, but I just want to get this before our break if we can. How soon could we have how large a reduction in the kinds of fuels that drag us into Middle East politics?
Right. Well, over a decade, the analysis from our group and others suggests that we could be 20 to 30% based on renewables. And that means a 20 to 30% drop in those same fossil fuels.
Is that significant in terms of our geopolitical involvement in the Middle East?
That is a tremendous step forward in the sense that the U.S. is producing a significant amount of oil and gas right now. It's actually declining our productivity over time, but it's enough to meet our energy needs if we used it wisely. And right now we use it for everything under the sun. When these solar, wind, biomass, other options are there and aren't being used. And so one way to put it in perspective is that every percent change, every percent reduction in the fossil fuel use, and we could do many, many percents very quickly, 20 or 30% mm-hmm. is a good benchmark. Mm-hmm. Those would dramatically change our balance of payments overseas. Those would dramatically invest in U.S. industries as opposed to extractive fossil fuels from overseas. And those would open up new markets we haven't even imagined yet.
Carl Ravigo, we're going to have to go to a break in just about a minute, but I want to get started on this. Mm-hmm. Daniel Kamen outlines the technological possibilities here, but he points to economic and political obstacles. What's the first of those that you would point to? How possible is this in a real politic way, looking at U.S. economic and political patterns?
I think it's extremely possible, and I would base my judgment on history. We already went through a very significant effort of increasing or improving our energy intensity, that GDP per unit of energy used that Dan was mentioning a moment ago. In response to the last OPEC crisis, mm-hmm. we increased fleet average economy in vehicles by 7 miles per gallon, and as a result, cut our dependence on Persian oil imports by 87% in a period that was just 9 years long. So I put the long term at about 20 years when we start seeing it, you know, we could eliminate our dependence on Persian Gulf oil. Mm-hmm. I think in that same period, we could easily have half of our electricity coming from renewable sources. And I think along the way, we are very likely to be surprised by the technology you mentioned in the introduction, the fuel cell.
Carl Ravigo, Daniel Kamen, and Jack Beatty, there's a lot more to talk about. We'll be right back to it. We're taking the long view of American energy policy, looking beyond the war on terror, asking how can we wean ourselves from the fuels that get us mixed up and maybe hogtied in the steps we'd like to take in the Middle East. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, in part two of our week-long series, Taking the Long View, we're looking at U.S. energy policy. Can we wean the United States from its dependence on fossil fuels? Can we wean the United States from its dependence on fuels that are linked to the Middle East and give us greater freedom in our foreign policy there? We're talking tonight with Daniel Kamen, professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and with Carl Ravigo, former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Energy in the Clinton administration, now Managing Director at the Rocky Mountain Institute. We're also joined by our own news analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, just before the break, Carl Ravigo was saying, in a crisis, it's possible to do very dramatic things, but gosh, the political obstacles have been high, and the Bush administration came in with a lot of oil connections.
Oh, it did. 17 people in the administration, I believe, are closely connected one way or another, either to oil or extractive industry or the automotive industry, all the big uglies. You know, there's a kind of a little parable about how, a political parable about how hard it is. We have slipped. You know, after the first oil embargo, we passed something called the CAFE standards, corporate average fuel efficiency, which basically said to the automakers, you got to get down the average miles per gallon for your fleets. And from 1975, when this was enacted, to today, to 1988, it went down from 16 miles a gallon to 25. But then in the first Bush administration, under political pressure, they repealed these standards. And then Bill Clinton was elected with Al Gore, who was Mr. Environment, who had written a book that said that the moral
Earth
equivalent
the
of, hey, this was the Holocaust, global warming was a potential Holocaust. And they did not bring back the CAFE standards. And in fact, of average fuel efficiency slipped in the Clinton-Gore administration, and they essentially instead of going ahead with the restrictions, they made a deal with the auto companies whereby they supported them with for research money to find a supercar, which hasn't turned out. I guess the point I'm making is leadership is crucial here. We just had a presidential campaign in which Gore, whose whole raison d'etre as a politician was to talk about energy, he mentioned global warming once. The whole justification for his candidacy.
Didn't want to carry that.
He didn't want to carry it. Mm-hmm. And if this guy wouldn't carry it, who will?
Dan Kamen and Carl Ravigo, I want to come to both of you on these because we know Americans love our cheap gasoline and even our SUVs, though we may be reconsidering right now. But at the same time, somewhere behind that, there seems to be a cynicism, both about the technologies that we've heard about for so long and never seem to truly make a big difference, and about the politics. Carl Ravigo, you first. Jack Beatty's taking a dig at the administration you worked in, the Clinton administration, and talking about how we haven't really adopted policies that make a more rapid energy policy evolution possible. What's up with that?
Well, I think Churchill said that democracy was the worst possible form of government except for all the others. I arrived in Washington full of vim and vigor. I was going to be in charge of renewable energy programs in the Clinton administration. I had met the vice president. I had seen these things go on and said, wow, this is great. At the same time, the 104th Congress was elected, and our system requires not just the leadership of the executive, but the financial support through appropriations of Congress. It is a rare thing when they all get together, the Senate, the House, and the executive. But that's what is needed in order to make dramatic moves forward. The status quo always wins when there is a deadlock either between the executive and the legislative or in the legislative itself. And that seems to be the situation we have now.
But even now, with this new crisis, is that not a stick of dynamite in this situation? I mean, we know that it wasn't long ago that Dick Cheney had the energy policy panel together, and they're talking about the energy crisis and a 20-year plan with all kinds of new fossil fuels, lots of new power plants going up. Could this current crisis somehow change the political calculus in a way that would propel a more radical changes in energy policy forward?
I think so, but not perhaps for the way that you're suggesting. If I had to choose a political party for myself, I'd call myself a free market green. I think actually market forces, not in the corny sense, but in the sense of just the sheer cost, is the thing that's facing us. Our energy system today is like somebody crafted a fine grandfather clock entirely out of crystal, and all it would take is a small tap from a play school hammer to turn it into just shards of useless glass.
So it's, what do you mean when you say brutal. Market forces face us? Will they help us or do they inhibit us here?
They will in the end help us, because we simply cannot afford to maintain all of the defense infrastructure, the market subsidies, the environmental destruction, and the costs associated with that for maintaining this brittle power system. We have to make a transition to the less expensive alternative, and I mean less expensive in all those other ways. So the markets and ultimately customer demand and resistance to paying taxes, I think, will become more important and have the potential to cross those political ideology lines to force us to use more resilient, more vernacular, more fungible and smaller technologies, that, like Dan was mentioning.
But what do you mean when you say a brittle energy system?
Well, like that crystal grandfather clock, it's vulnerable in a great many places. I mean, it's still true today, as it was in 1981 when my boss, Amory Lovins and Hunter Lovins, wrote Brittle Power, that six people with rifles could shut off 75% of the oil and gas to the East Coast without ever leaving the state of Louisiana.
Don't tell them, for heaven's sake.
Well, the question is where, right? I had a utility executive tell me that similarly six bullets in the right transformers in the state of Texas could cripple the electric system there.
So when you say brittle, you mean vulnerable to terrorist attack?
Vulnerable to terrorist attack, vulnerable to economic disruption, vulnerable to economic cycles, as we recently saw just in the past year on natural gas prices, vulnerable to catastrophic failures is what happens when a large multi-thousand megawatt nuclear power plant goes offline and we depend on it for a substantial part of our electricity, vulnerable to the singular event.
Daniel Kamen, let us bring you back in here. Please give us some examples of the kind of more resilient energy sources that Carl Ravagot is referring to here. Certainly. It simple, but lay it out for us, and how soon could they play a significant role?
Sure. Let me do that, but let me first start with one more example to add to what Carl said about the brittleness.
Go for it.
When you think about the OPEC crisis in the 70s, what fraction of our oil do we think was controlled by these OPEC, petroleum overlords?
It felt like a lot.
It felt like a lot. I ask my students in class all the time, and they'll raise their hand when I say, do you think it was 50%? Do you think it was 40%? The actual amount of oil that they controlled at the time was about 6% of what the U.S. was purchasing.
And all it took was shutting that off to bring us to gas lines and our knees.
A lot more of the system was affected by the decisions that 6% entailed. Mm-hmm. That's the economic equivalent of the six bullets fired in the right transformers. Mm-hmm. It's a very brittle system when the way you get your energy is to pump it out of the ground far away.
So what's the technology path out of that?
Well, the paths out of that are wonderfully in front of us, and we're not supporting them. So, for example, Carl mentioned before fuel cells. Fuel cells do several things. One is they produce, with the input of hydrogen and oxygen, they produce electricity and warm or hot water.
What is a fuel cell? Is it like a battery?
It's basically a battery that runs backwards. The neat thing about fuel cells is not only that they provide electricity, but they do two other things that are dramatic changes in how we think about energy. One is that they provide a way to store energy. And right now, we generate electricity and we've got to use it. Mm-hmm. Almost all the energy has got to go somewhere right away. It makes it a very unusual market. Mm-hmm. Fuel cells provide both power plants that can be moved around, but they also provide energy that can be stored. You can put the hydrogen in, you can move it around. And they do one other thing, which is totally new for the energy field, and that is that they allow us to use our energy in doses where we want it. We don't have to think about 1,000, 2,000 megawatt power plants. You can have a fuel cell power plant in your basement. You can have a fuel cell in your car, and you can use them interchangeably. And the interesting thing about fuel cells as one of the key building blocks in our industry is that fuel cells allow us to make a transition cost effectively. And by that I mean that fuel cells with reformers that change gasoline into the hydrogen form,
okay,
can run off of gasoline. So our current infrastructure can be utilized to power them.
Mm-hmm.
They can also run off of ethanol and methanol, clean biological fuels. And they can also run off of hydrogen generated directly, for example, at solar panels, windmills, even nuclear power plants, of which I'm not exactly a large fan.
So if they're so great, why don't I have one in my basement right now if I could turn my own house into a power generating plant?
You don't have one because the U.S., despite these advances in energy efficiency and some impressive changes in how photocells and things have worked, have massively underinvested in all alternatives to fossil fuels because the fossil fuel government connection is so strong. So, for example, when the Cheney Task Force did its actions last year, essentially every witness that got significant time in front of them came from their Houston and fossil fuel industry-based buddies. It was not an open discussion of the alternatives. Until we break that process where we don't think about alternatives because of a lock-in to existing technology, we're not going to take advantage of things like, as Carl said, generating up to half our electricity or more from renewables. And those are things that are all technically and economically possible. We've just got to open these markets up.
We're still waiting to hear how we're going to break that stranglehold. And Carl Robico, we want to hear more from you, but we have a lot of callers who want to join the conversation as well. I want to bring some in right now. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're taking the long view of U.S. energy policy. It matters. It's at play every day in this crisis and what's unfolding in the Middle East. Where can we be 10 years from now? Call us. Tom is on the line. Welcome, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that we've seen over and over again how vulnerable our economy is to sudden spikes in oil prices. And one of the stated goals of Osama bin Laden is the overthrow of the Saudi monarchy. And if al-Qaeda or other fundamentalist groups are ultimately successful in doing this and that supply was cut off even for a short time, the effects would be just kind of catastrophic on our economy. And, you know, we need to insulate our economy from this possibility. And the only
that's the
way
point,
I
isn't
see,
it? That is the point.
The only way I can see that this can be done is to commit ourselves to policies like doubling the amount of the average fuel efficiency of cars in this country and increasing the energy efficiency of our homes and industry. The way to insulate our economy is to insulate our homes, basically.
That's a great line, Tom, and thank you for your call. I want to put that to Carl Robigo. Carl Robigo, how about it? We know that the Bush administration has strong oil industry connections, but they also have to care, as the administration, as Republicans, about national security. And Tom points out the difficulty. Can this presidency lead us away from oil dependency if that means a better national security future?
I think they can, and I think they should. I think we've had studies from the National Academies showing that even under fairly constrained government analysis type framework, significant improvements in gas vehicle miles per gallon are possible. We at Rocky Mount Institute have worked on even bigger thoughts. Let's take just an idea that's not beyond the realm, something like increasing average economy to 67 miles per gallon. We already have on the streets today Hondas and Toyotas that are getting 50 and more miles per gallon.
Okay.
So with a push, we could get up there. In fact, we're demonstrating with the hypercar concept a vehicle that gets significantly more effective miles per gallon, but it runs on a fuel cell. If you had an average fuel economy of 67 miles per gallon, then every automobile tank would have 3 weeks' worth of oil supply in it. That means that if somebody shuts down Saudi Arabian oil, we wouldn't feel it in our cars for 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. Not only that, it would stretch the supply that normally exists in all the infrastructure from the wellhead to the car gasoline tank so that it would last effectively a year. So tripling our auto fuel economy would give us an oil system that would not feel a Saudi interruption shock for a year.
But unless I miss something, that's not where this administration's been heading. I think that the Cheney team on energy assumed no new efficiency standards would be adopted past the standards of the year 2000.
And that is correct. And there
that doesn't sound like 67 miles a gallon.
No.
Jack Beattie, am I missing something here?
I think so. I mean, environmentalism, I think, is the great sleeping issue in American politics. It's what the political scientists call a valence issue. There is no other side. Even delegates to the Republican convention last year, even self-described conservative delegates, call themselves environmentalists, and a majority said that if it came to a trade-off between economic growth and the environment, they would pick the environment.
But you're the guy who said Al Gore didn't mention global warming.
This is, to me, one of the great puzzles. You've got this valence issue where there's no other side that expresses itself other than the self-interested one of big business and so on. But no, in polling, this is an 80, 75, 85% issue, and yet it hasn't been a politician even who was built for it like Al Gore didn't have the courage to touch it. Jimmy Carter was the only one who got close. He talked about energy conservation as the moral equivalent of war. Well, now by God we have the war, and well, if we problem, can't use but, this,
but here's the real problem. Issue here.
Daniel Kamis,
here's the problem. Okay,
yeah,
go ahead, Dan.
Sorry, I mean the real issue here is that saying you're an environmentalist and deciding how to translate that into action is the place where the U.S. has absolutely fallen down. We have example after example of when we actually did invest in these things, like with the phasing out of CFCs, like with improving the efficiency of light bulbs, like with building cleaner cars if we want to, that those innovations are both possible and they end up being much cheaper than anyone estimated when you begin the process. And until we say we are going to make a significant effort to translate that interest in the environment into policies, we're not going to see action. And so, for example, at the same time that people are saying it's a tragedy we're so dependent on foreign oil, the bill in the Senate that would just simply close the loophole for SUV vehicles, mm-hmm. to require them to have a little better gas mileage and to get them included in some of these fleet averages, that bill is bogged down. And despite the fact that it has some impressive bipartisan support, Senator Feinstein, Senator Snowe are both in support of it, it seems like a no-brainer. And it's probably one where if those investments were made, the oil company, the car companies that are claiming this could hurt them would benefit. One of the most interesting examples is I testified before the Senate this summer in front of the Finance Committee, and we're talking about this. I was testifying with someone from Honda, and he said, you know, I'm really kind of sort of perplexed about the U.S. energy decisions. Honda has made our vehicles 1 to 2% better each year for the past decade and a half. That's a lot of improvement. Mm-hmm. But no one has pushed us to make those improvements in terms of fuel efficiency. We now have vehicles that can play videos and you can make phone calls from them. You can keep, you know, food cold in them. All these are things that we invested in to make them more user-friendly.
Dan Cameron, we've got another break coming up, and I want to give 30 seconds to Carl Robigo. Carl Robigo, why shouldn't we be cynical? We all want to be environmentalists, but we've heard this for so long.
Because we have an intolerance for things percolating. We forget, for example, that it took 17 years to commercialize the zipper from the time that it was invented. More importantly, we have had these energy issues portrayed as being out there. I'm not accusing mm-hmm. you of having the wrong subject for this talk, because it's important to have vision. But where the environmental polling numbers fall down is salience. People think the problems are so big, nothing can be done about them. And that's where the leadership comes in.
We're looking for what can be done on the energy front tonight, not overnight, but in the long view, maybe 10 years out. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight we're taking the long view of U.S. energy policy, looking beyond the fog of war to see where we might be, ideally, 10 years out. And what if we fall short? We're joined by Daniel Kamen, he's professor at University of California, Berkeley, and by Carl Robigo, managing director at the Rocky Mountain Institute, and by our own news analyst, Jack Beattie. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, and there's a long line to jump in. Let's go straight there. Donna is on the line. Welcome, Donna. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question has to do with the even longer view, and that is, maybe what happens if, say, our economy and other Western economies, mm-hmm. like I know, for example, Iceland is already planning to convert to a hydrogen-based economy, or they're working on it. What happens to the stability of the Middle East in that situation? Do we have to worry about that as a sort of a second, you know, a next
Yeah, it's a great question. Carl Robigo, would you rise to that one?
Well, I will say that it is a concern. I mean, if we are not dependent on Saudi Arabian oil, then we certainly have to wonder what Saudi Arabia does for a living. The good news is that there are a great many countries in this world, and there is a finite amount of oil. I think they will always find markets. But like we currently will have to retool our energy systems, which are based on heavy use of fossil fuel and nuclear energy over the long term, they'll have to retool their economies as well. And it's important what Dan said before, that when we talk about a vision of a cleaner energy future or a clean energy future, we get there less expensively if we use our current system as a springboard, make the transition rational. I do want to add one point, though, mm-hmm. sort of based on the conversation before the break.
Mm-hmm.
Critically, I think that this country faces a turning point where that perhaps our friends in Europe have actually already decided to embrace. We have had, contrary to all the demonstrations during the last presidential campaign, mm-hmm. we've had energy policy in this country for at least 100 years. It's been a cheap energy policy.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was that if we could make energy cheap, then our manufacturing and other industries would be able to succeed in world economies, and we would gain economic power in the global marketplace as a result of it. The world recognized, I think, in the last 10 to 20 years that there is a quality energy policy strategy, one in which you try to get you use the best energy resources and you make money. Another point Dan alluded to, you make money and you grow your economy on sustainable technologies. The Europeans have recognized that. That's why they have no problems embracing the Kyoto protocols. It seems like the current administration is bent on just one more trip round the merry-go-round, one more time that we can try to push the cheap energy policy, an energy policy mm-hmm. based on mass flow. They have a lot of things working in their behavior, in their favor, and then justifying, if you will, this behavior. In my former life as a public utility commissioner for the state of Texas,
mm-hmm.
I learned that when you have very large power plants, like nuclear power plants that cost $12 billion, you set up the system, you set up the rates, you set up the collection of revenues in a way that favors the movement of more kilowatt hours, the sale of more electricity.
Sure.
You try to minimize the per unit cost. You play to the cheap energy game in order to make that system work.
Carl Robigo, I want to get some more callers in here. We take your point, and we know Dick Cheney wants to build a whole lot more power plants. And to Donna's point, I guess the Saudis know what's coming. Sheikh Yamani, who was so big in OPEC, said the Stone Age didn't end because they ran out of stones, and the Oil Age won't end because we run out of oil. They know a new technology future is coming, but when will it arrive? How effective can it be? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Paul is on the line. Welcome, Paul. You're on the air.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to make a few points, four or five points quickly.
We'll make them real quick because there's a lot of others who want to come on.
I think your guests are not very balanced. I think that they're selling us really a load of moonshine.
In what respect?
Well, first of all, the alternative technologies they propose, like, for instance, solar and wind, are really reaching the limits of their efficiency. Material science.
That's actually not true.
Well, let me finish the point. There are limits to how efficient we can make solar and wind.
Okay, limits to efficiency. Let's go on, Paul.
Quickly, ask them how much land you would have to devote to putting up solar panels and windmills to save power one city.
Okay, a couple more.
And then finally, insofar as if we're going to invest in technology in the future, why not nuclear fusion instead of wasting our time on solar and wind, which really have limited possibilities, especially when the oil-producing countries, if they ever feel that those sources of energy can undercut them, they'll lower their prices.
Got it. Paul, don't take offense, but we're going to move on fast to bring more in. And Dan Kamen, to ask you very quickly to respond to those points. Are you selling us moonshine here, technically?
Absolutely not. In fact, the efficiency of solar panels has increased by about 1% a year for the past two decades. The theoretical limit is more than twice where we are now. The area, we often hear this saying, well, the area required to do this. And in fact, if you take the area we currently devote to our fossil fuel infrastructure
mm-hmm.
and mining and all the various ancillary services, the area required to do a renewable-based economy, and it depends, of course, what mix you use, is on that scale or smaller without all these complicated foreign entanglements. So the area requirement gets brought up a number of ways and is essentially false.
But you're saying it's not going to take the entire Great Plains states to power
their... Absolutely not. In fact, the numbers are
remarkably smaller than that. And there's another feature which is lost in that discussion. When you think about the area required, for example, for solar panels and for wind farms are area would have to be placed out in areas, plains and fields and all, but those can be used for multiple things. We've already seen farmers in the Midwest, ranchers, who are selling right, leasing rights to put windmills on their land and continuing to have crops and or cattle.
What about nuclear fusion? Paul raised nuclear fusion. Is that a realistic possibility?
It absolutely – I mean, I'm a professor of nuclear energy, but let me do the nuclear piece. And, of course, Cheney and others have argued that nuclear is the clean alternative.
Mm-hmm.
I have to disagree with that, not because of nuclear power plants. Nuclear plants themselves, A, can be quite safe, can be passively safe, and could be ones that supply a considerable amount of energy. The problem is the system that we use to build that industry has been one that has been based on subsidies beyond anything we can imagine for other areas. The so-called Price-Anderson Act that limits liability of nuclear plants is a huge windfall. We would not have an industry without it. We also have a problem that our conception of nuclear and industry that we designed 30, 40 years ago was based on reprocessing a lot of the waste into more fuel. We decided not to do that for some very good proliferation reasons. Mm-hmm. That means our volume of waste is thousands of times more than what we thought when we talked about nuclear energy being too cheap to meter.
So it's not as good as it looks.
It has great potential, but the way we've managed nuclear power has turned potentially a wonderful resource into a real sow's ear.
Dan Kamen and Carl Ravigo, we've just got one more minute. You each get half of it. Handicap this next decade for us. How much progress will we make? How much really significant progress? Dan Kamen, you first, please.
I think that we will have 10 to 15% of our energy from renewables in a decade, which will seem good, but we could be two or three times that.
Carl Ravigo, do you think we'll even make that? And if we do, what difference, how much of a difference will it make in our geopolitical position?
I think it turns the tables of the discussion on geopolitical issues, and I think we can reach that number. I think we'll be surprised going even further. I think that fuel cells, in addition, will probably be commercial in vehicles within those 5 to 10 years, and with the potential that playing out to a 20-year horizon where we virtually have a mega OPEC issue on running around on the street for us. So I think that our intolerance of these costs, and I think the opportunity of these technologies and their inherent efficiencies, will have them win the day once we get past the old habits of yesteryear.
Carl Ravigo,
open that market for him.
We'll wait and see. We're in the show me state, but we want to believe. Dan Kamen, thanks for joining us, and Carl Ravigo also.
Thank you.
Carl Ravigo is managing director of the Rocky Mountain Institute. Dan Kamen is director of the Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory in Berkeley, California, and professor at the University of California, Berkeley. Jack Beatty, there you've got optimism from two people who work in the belly of this beast, and yet I'm sure a lot of our listeners are scratching their head because we have been hearing this since the OPEC oil crisis, at least, and it doesn't seem like it's ever quite added up to what we expected.
Yeah, that word that Carl used, salience, people are attitudinally environmentalists, but they don't think it's the overriding issue. And yet here's a moment where a president could say, folks, you want to sacrifice, you want to participate in this war, here's how you do it. You drive a car to work, take your name. You buy a bulb, buy the energy efficient bulb, get our tax credit to insulate your house. This is how we will fight the war on terrorism. This is how we will make our nation secure in energy. And this is how our children and posterity will look back on us and say, you saved the world in your generation.
And if George W. Bush doesn't say that, and we suspect he may not, do you think it may happen anyway?
Well, you know, if we can only start paying the real costs of energy, the market will do it. That is to say, if we can start paying the taxes that really should be on energy, reflecting all the infrastructure, all the foreign policy, all the military that we build into it, then market forces would take it away.
Tomorrow night on The Long View, we look at the global economy. Jack, thanks very much for being with us tonight. You can continue this conversation online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. Now, dreaming of a healed Afghanistan. Amin Azami is a poet and clinical psychologist in Nashville, Tennessee. He's also an optimist who can see past the devastation of his homeland to a bright future.
Afghanistan is a nation with over 2 decades of war and human suffering. I'm an Afghan who has been living in the U.S. for 28 years, but I have never lost track of what is going on in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is a dying nation. The atrocities that have been done to it since 1979 are out of reach of the imagination. The people there have been denied their basic human rights, and the world has watched. Afghanistan is a loving nation. Anyone who has traveled or lived in Afghanistan will testify about the goodness of these suffering people. My hope for Afghanistan 10 years down the road is to see in Afghanistan where the democratic government, which includes representative of all ethnic groups. I hope Afghans finally learn from the horrible experience of the past to believe in unity and not division. Afghan refugees should finally be able to return home and be able to work and rebuild the nation. Equality between men and women is essential. I believe women can be a major force, both economically and politically, in Afghanistan. Hopefully, Afghans will be more sensitive to each other, and ethnic differences will not be a major issue for them. In 10 years, I strongly believe all the major roads in Afghanistan will be rebuilt, and every Afghan will be able to travel without fear. As a tradition, all Afghans will be able to live and travel anywhere in the country, regardless of their different ethnic backgrounds. Afghanistan is rich in natural resources. Perhaps natural resources can allow Afghanistan to be financially independent of other countries. I believe many young Afghans who are well-educated and living abroad currently will return home and contribute their knowledge and skills. Because of this, Afghanistan will be closer and friendlier to the West, especially the United States. I would like to see Afghanistan free from landmines, so its farmers can rebuild their farms and orchards. Afghanistan has been famous for its exquisite fresh and dried fruits. Afghans and the world will then be able to once again enjoy the delightful products of Afghanistan. I believe Western countries will be involved in rebuilding new industries together with the Afghans. The influence of mullahs and other religious figures will not be as strong. Traditionally, Afghans have never been influenced strongly by religious figures, and they will never forget the ugliness of the Taliban. On the political front, Afghanistan will have friendly relations with all of its neighbors, especially the new republics to the north. However, Afghanistan will not have a friendly relationship with Pakistan. Afghans will remember that the atrocities that have been done to them have not been just by the communist governments and the former Soviet Union, but also by Pakistan, who supported Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, the butcher of Kabul, who killed thousands of innocent people and destroyed Kabul in the early 1990s. Pakistan created a Taliban against the will of Afghans. Consequently, Afghans will not forget the generosity of the United States, which came to their rescue. While Pakistan still interfered with their internal affairs and covertly aided the Taliban.
Amin Azimi is a poet and clinical psychologist in Nashville, Tennessee. We'd like to hear from you. How has your life changed since September 11th? How are the attacks in Afghanistan affecting you? Send your submissions for radio diaries by email to special@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You've been listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston.